That being said, we do have another. Well, let's look at our old activity first. So we've got the signals activity that we did. Let me find my. Does anybody want to like share their process graph before we just like jump into the solution and going over it? I know it's
totally missed this activity. I'm sorry.
No, it's fine. I think it's actually really helpful to look at the code and just and make sure you know what's going on in the code. And the process graph is definitely helpful. If you know how to do that, you're not going to get anything that's that complicated on the final. So if you can do that process graph, you're good. If you can do the process graphs from like our older activities, you're probably still okay. Like we're not going to give you like, you know how our tests are. We're not going to give you something that like takes 20 minutes to graph out to answer like a question. So it's just a little exercise. I think more than anything, it's like helpful to take a look at that code and see how the synchronization issues can happen and how like wait PID works and how that exit status like signaling happens. So let's go ahead and take a look at that. I'll pull that up. Give me one sec. The solution is actually up on the schedule now. So if you, let me share my screen. If you go to the schedule, you can pull it up. And we have this nifty process graph right here. If your graph doesn't look exactly like this, we saw one this morning that another student in Matt's section that had done where it was like the child processes were coming off the bottom. And I actually liked that one too. It's just, it's really for you. There's no like, you know, it's a concrete right way to do this. But if you can read something and it makes sense to you, this stuff is really helpful again, because it's like, if you need to go through and figure out for a question, like how many print statements there are given like a certain like bit of code or something like that, the process graphs can make that a lot faster.
It was beautiful. Who made that?
The what?
It looks beautiful. Who made that?
Oh, I did that.
Oh,
that
wow.
Is the, that's the advantage of having a tablet. Because before it was drawn out in pen, it's really hard to like correct stuff and do that in pen, but
I agree.
Tablets are tight. And then as far as the code goes, hopefully some of you guys have seen some of this stuff in Shell Lab. Here we have like this signal function, which we know actually registers our handler or installs that handler for us for the SIGINT signal. We've got this for loop here that is creating processes. As we know, in the child process, that PID will be zero, and in the parent process, that PID will be some non-zero PID that's the child PID that got created. And then if we look down here, the next questions, nothing here is like super tricky. The parent process is sending a SIGINT signal. The child process receives a SIGINT signal and then breaks out of that while loop. We haven't really talked about these little macros that much, but you will need to use these guys in Shell Lab. I don't know if we'll go into them more if there are questions and we have more time. What Matt told his section was just to look it up in the text. You will use it in some way like this to check how a child exited, what the exit status was, et cetera, et cetera. So if you haven't done this activity, I would try to go through it. If not that, I would at the very least like read through this code and make sure like you're able to connect the dots between these like comments and the actual code. And then if you have any questions, let us know. I think it's, especially having the solutions, it's pretty straightforward actually. The only thing that we had talked about doing, which is like can bring up some weird questions, is like in this example, I have a little arrow pointing from, you know, the exit with the status down to weight pit. It doesn't necessarily travel in that direction. Like there's, that can get like complex and there's like a case to be made for both ways. I was like, maybe I'll just take the arrow out entirely. But just so you know, like that's the only like kind of weird thing that I think might bring up some questions. We have another, whoops, I did not mean to do that. We have another activity. You guys are still seeing my screen, right? I didn't mess that up. Okay, yeah. Okay, so we have this new activity that is on the schedule now. This proc activity, and this is kind of a slog to do, not in the classroom. Let me pull this back. So, you know, it looks like this. I would, if you have the ability, maybe like print it out. It's really just kind of a walkthrough with a couple of little questions. But it starts to get you familiar with like some file descriptors and stuff like that. The way that you're gonna actually have to do this at this point, let's see. This has to be done on the server. So, I mean, the way to do this is to go ahead and actually, I think that what will happen today is we'll probably put up Matt's lecture, because he went in pretty into depth with a bunch of terminal stuff that there's no way I'm gonna remember all of it, but I'll just show you a little, a couple of like examples of some things that you can see. So this is using a PDF that we get from the internet. So what am I doing? Oh yeah. Okay, so if we go to Systems Lab, our little like guacamole site. We will, we will use that wget command to grab this document, this PDF file from the web and store it as a local file. These are actually the lecture slide notes. Okay, cool. So now we have that, and we can go ahead and use this PDF reader that we utilize sometimes in this class, called events. So we'll call events and have it open that file. So now you can see it open that PDF for us. How do I get you out of full screen from here? Okay. And then it's going to have you do some other stuff. So we can open another terminal. Nope. And look at our running processes. So here you can see we've got two different like bash processes using. I've got two different bash terminals open. Here's our PS process. Here's our events. You want to go ahead and as you run through this, like keep track of your events process ID so you can use that later on. But this is just a walkthrough. It shouldn't actually be that hard or take that much time, but I would recommend going through it. It helps a little bit. You get to kind of see like some context switching in action or just some evidence of context switching. You do a little bit of like output redirection stuff, input redirect. So if you haven't dealt with a lot of that, like this will give you an idea of at least like what that looks like. Any questions about that? Okay. So Matt said that maybe you guys would need a little bit more time with race condition stuff. Do you feel like that's true? I know we like went through it really briefly and I feel like his class got a little bit more of it. So let me pull up the slides with that at the beginning. Race conditions, okay. Okay, cool. I don't want that. Okay, so I know we looked at these for like a split second, the last class that I had with you guys. This is a little joke example of a race condition. In this case, the punchline comes before, you know, the prerequisite part of that joke. So that's, you know, that's that joke explained. And there it is again. Okay, so let's remember, of course, that we have no way to predict which order the parent and child processes might run in. And in fact, that could change every time. It could be, there's just no way to like, you can't code in a way that like expects prediction of that because it's not reliable. Let's see. Is that the only? Okay, so we looked at this and this, the example here is, there is a situation where the child could actually terminate and SIG child handler could run before add job gets called. So in that situation, you would run your SIG child handler, delete job would get called before that job was even added. And then it would SIG child handler would finish and return back. And at some point after that, the parent process calls add job. So then that job gets added and that job will then never get deleted. So this is like an example of like a typical race condition or something that you might like, you would definitely encounter if you didn't like use any kind of signal blocking, right? Does anybody, I feel like, I don't know if you guys got to go through it more on Friday. Does anybody have any questions about signal blocking? It's kind of like complex. So you know that we use,
I do.
Okay.
Can I ask away?
Yeah, go ahead and ask. So, and also just so you guys know, there's also this slide that has, as you know, we like use SIG proc mask. We use that for blocking and unblocking. This is an example of how you could use this to make sure that that doesn't happen. But okay, go ahead, Michael. Let's see if I can answer your question or if it's going to break my
brain. My questions suck. I'm sorry.
It's okay. It makes me feel a lot better that like, even when Matt answers them, they're like answers. I'm like, okay, well, I wouldn't have known that. So.
Yeah. Do we have like the prototype for SIG mask in one of the slides? Because it would help.
Yeah, I think we do actually. So not in these slides, obviously. Give me one sec. I actually think.
I mean, I can probably pull it up too.
I think if you look at the slides from Signals, at the very end, I think there are some slides that we really raced through. Let me make sure that that's true.
Yeah, it seems fine.
Yeah, okay, cool. Yeah, so let's go look at that. Okay. So right, here yeah. is this calling, and the other thing that all of these like kind of like macros here, these like sig empty set, fill set, add set, think of these as like vector, bit vectors also. So like these will allow you to like save signals that you've like blocked or like masked or blocked before, or like block all signals at once or clear the whole set, like create an empty set and then add a signal one at a time. That's like what these things are gonna allow you to do. So here, if you look at this code, like it is creating an empty set, an empty bit vector and storing it at that address where mask is pointed. That's what that ampersand is, remember, it's like an address. And now we're going to add to that like set that bit vector that we created, we're gonna add like set the sig int bit basically. So we're gonna add that to be able to like be blocked and blocked. So any kind of blocking or unblocking we do with that like set of with that bit vector is going to affect like the sig int signal. Does that much make sense so far? And so whenever you are blocking something, this is the action you're doing, right? You're blocking. This is the bit vector of signals that you want to block. And you're gonna go ahead and save this like previously blocked, this like bit vector of signals that was blocked before you did this. So you can return to that, right? So whenever you like unblock, you can just restore that previous, that signal set. I'm trying to give a way to say that makes the most sense. And then there are some like little examples in the end of this code here. This is kind of, I think this is the code example of that process graph that we had talked about. So this will allow that like potentially the child can terminate before the parent runs add job. Sorry, my dog. And this is like, this could allow this to happen. So this is assuming that the parent will run before the child. And then there's some ways that you can also kind of fix this stuff in here.
Question had to do specifically, can you go to the first slide?
Yeah.
That you should. Two slides, yeah, right there.
Okay.
You know, like we saved the previous mask, and then we use it again to effectively unblock. So we block and unblock, but the unblocking we use the previous mask. And I guess, like, my question is, like, you know, I determined what mask all was, or in this case maybe I want to block the child, whoever I determined that, but I didn't determine previous all. Like, obviously that's maybe just block signals that took place, who knows what they are. So like how do I know if, like, when I restore it, like how can I be confident that previous all is actually like unblocking the right?
Here's where that's gonna signals. Come from, actually. And I don't know if this will answer your question or not, but anytime a process creates a child process, it will inherit all of the block signals from that parent process. So perhaps like that is coming from somewhere else. Perhaps that set is just empty, who knows? There might not be any. Yeah. I actually don't even know how you would check that. I'm sure there's a way.
Right.
Yeah,
it's just interesting because, like, when I block and unblock in my code, like, I just kind of just did what the book did and just used the previous mask. And like, I don't know what's in there, but it works. So I guess it doesn't unblock, or it unblocks everything I want it to. But you know, why wouldn't I just do unblock all, you know? Or like set mask and then like do like an empty mask.
I think that the only thing there to be scared about, and I'm not even sure what situations would arise from this, are that you are then like overriding, and this might be fine. Yeah, you're overriding any kind of signal blocking that happened like in the parent. And then you have to be careful because any new processes, and obviously this, you are careful at this when you call fork and you create children, but that means that any of the processes that you create in eval also inherit like whatever blocked signals are there whenever that's created.
All right, I'm getting into details. We can probably just move on. I think I'm good. Okay.
Does anybody else have any questions about that? Like, I think that at least shows you kind of the syntax of that, and it should give you an idea. If you move through these slides and you still have questions about stuff that's going on, come to help hours. And actually, I think this is at the beginning of the next slide set. Here we go. So hopefully by now, like, you started your eval and you probably pulled your eval from the book, which is totally fine. Of course, everybody does that. It's not a complete eval. So there's some things in there that are a little bit funky. And one of them is this: we are not going to use wait pit in eval. Don't call wait in eval. That does not go for wait FG, which is just like, is not related, but is like named in a similar way. That's fine. You do need to call that in eval, but all of your reaping, like your wait pit stuff, should be done in your SIG child handler. So if you still got your wait pit in eval, you still have a little bit of work to do in SIG child, right? Here we go. Yeah. So wait FG and wait pit can be confused, but they're different. Wait pit will be used in SIG child handler, and wait FG can be pretty simple. It can just check and see that the jobs list, whatever job it's checking, is like in the jobs list still. And we've got FG pit.
I just erased my entire shell.
You did?
Yeah.
That is very rough.
Damn. But not the whole thing, but it's all fucked up. I deleted a giant segment.
Yeah, that sucks. It really sucks. Oh. Like, if you've gotten like far enough to like get into like your handlers and stuff, and like
it was done.
That sucks. How did you?
I had a swap file, and I assumed that I recovered. Like, I was basically like working, and the terminal like just stalled, so I just exited out, and then when I opened it up again. It's like, oh, here's the swap file. Like, I was like, okay, I'll recover it, because assuming it was just like what I had worked on. And I guess before it stalled, I had like probably deleted something. Like, it deleted a massive segment, just because that happens when I use Vim. I'll hit like 3 keystrokes and like a giant chunk will be gone. And I'm like, oh shit, okay, undo. So that happened. And then the terminal stalled. So I killed it and then reopened it, recovered the swap file, and the swap file was just fucked.
That sucks a lot.
It's okay.
Hey, what you might try doing is like quit out again, try to open it back up, see if that same swap file screen comes up again, and then just like
it didn't. I removed it.
Oh, okay. Damn, I'm sorry. Ouch. You didn't happen to submit to Autolab, did you?
No.
Oh man, okay.
Yeah, you have like I feel like you have an older submission for Autolab, but I don't know if it's too old to help you. Hey guys, that's also like not a bad reason to like submit to Autolab occasionally as you work, because it like basically keeps a backup for you in case stuff like that happens. So if you haven't submitted to Autolab yet, you don't have to be worried about the fact that, like, first of all, just know that like you get like I think quite a few points, not quite a few, but maybe like 6 to 8 points pretty quickly. And then as you start breaking things or like writing more code, it'll break stuff and you'll like lose all your points again. So I would just try and submit what you have to Autolab if you have anything at all so that you can get like have a copy of that somewhere. But also, so we have these, like we have some helper methods for you. And they are things like get job PID, FG PID. I think we also had talked about like add job, clear job. Sorry, I'm kind of cruising around the slides here looking for that. But we like make sure you check and see which helper methods we have already written for you, because those will likely be very helpful in some of these things, and they simplify stuff a lot for you. There's some pointer stuff that we kind of haven't talked about, and I'm not going to go into a lot of detail with it today because I think we're getting into pointers pretty soon. But if you're confused about like this job struct, it's so this is like the struct that like is your list of jobs. It's an array of structs. So job 0 is a single job, but jobs with no index is a pointer to the beginning of that array. So it's just an array, you know, you can have an array of like any data type. This is an array of structs, of job structs. There we go. Add job and clear job are some little helper methods in here. If it helps you to see how they're coded, to like clarify that a little bit, that's what that is. This also, you have probably seen this little guy right here. These can be really helpful if you have a KNR that goes into them there. This will dereference something. So it's a little notation that if you've seen it and you don't know what that means, that is that. There we go. We've even given you the page in KNR to check it out. Okay. So let me make sure that I hit everything that I wanted to there. Oh, I think I told you this. I think that Matt's lecture will probably be the recording that gets posted today, and he goes into that process activity, that proc activity, that like, and he goes into it pretty in depth with some of the like terminal stuff. So if anything, like just watch that little piece of his lecture if you are working on it and you're not really sure what you're supposed to be getting out of it. That's like a good place to start. It's only about 5, maybe 7 minutes of him like kind of like walking through some things that you should be seeing. So that actually, I mean, we are wrapped up on chapter 8. So what the rest of the semester will look like is we'll go through chapter 6 a little bit, which is going to be memory and locality stuff. And then we're going to head back to, I believe, chapter 3 for Attack Lab and finish up some of that stack stuff that we didn't get to. And this is like, I would say, kind of a primer for you guys for OS. If you've taken or are taking computer org right now, you probably have seen a lot of this. But this comes up again and again. So you will see this several times. But you go, like, I think you go pretty in-depth. At least in my OS class, we went pretty in-depth with this stuff. And then, like, virtual memory and paging, obviously. So dip in. Okay, so you guys may have seen these before. They are, this is what your RAM looks like. So we've got these little chips, and they're normally packaged in a cell like this at this point, because you know, pretty much everybody's got more than 4 gigs of RAM. So they're normally put on like a little cell. I don't remember what these are. I think these are the DIMMs. I forget what they're actually called, these like blocks of RAM. But the basic storage unit of RAM is a bit, so is a cell. Each cell will hold 1 bit. Oh, there we go, modules. It's like right in front of me. So there are two types of RAM. We've got static RAM, SRAM, we have dynamic RAM, which is your DRAM. So as you can see, static RAM is way, way, way more expensive than dynamic RAM, and that's used for things like cache. Your dynamic RAM, so your static RAM doesn't need to be like constantly refreshed. Like your RAM is still volatile memory, but the static doesn't have to like have a constant refresh the way that dynamic is like constantly refreshed. So that's what we use for cache. For things that are constantly needing that refresh, like main memories and frame buffers, we'll go ahead and use dynamic RAM. And you can see if you look at the SRAM, the transistors per bit is quite a bit, is, you know, quite a bit more complicated than the dynamic RAM. So there we go. Okay, so both of those are examples of volatile memory. So they've got volatile memory and non-volatile memory. What that means, basically, the volatile memory is that if your machine gets powered off, you're going to lose that information. Non-volatile memory, if you think about like our disks, that is going to be memory that retains value even after you turn it off. So there are some examples here of that. There's read-only memory, which gets programmed like during production, so it gets programmed at one time. Programmable read-only memory can be programmed once. It's usually like early on in the process as well. There's erasable programmable only memory, electrically erasable programmable. This is really a mouthful. And then actually, if you think about like flash memory, like a flat, like a, you know, your external hard drives or your flash drives, or even like what's in our like our mobile phones, that's just like a fancy version of this electronically erasable programmable read-only memory. So that's what we use that for. Then some uses for that are firmware programs like BIOS, controllers for disk, network cards, graphics accelerators, et cetera, solid state disks, and disk caches. Okay, so here we have a diagram of this bus structure connecting CPU and memory. Remember how we talk about how, or you know, like we look at like a little bit of code in assembly and we're moving some data from memory into a register file. So like conceptually, that's what that is. This is a this is like diagramming that. So the way that we do that is by utilizing buses. I always think of buses as like an actual like bus that transports data from one place to another, like, you know, like you would ride a bus to work. But they're like wires. So they do that kind of data transport for us, and they're typically shared by like multiple devices. Yeah. Any questions so far? I feel like this is like so straightforward after going through like things like pointers and signals. But maybe that's like a nice break for your brain. We have this handy CPU. Yes.
To like what detail should we like study this? Because okay. I've always found it difficult to like memorize all these acronyms and these graphs and stuff.
Some people love this stuff, like the engineering minded people. I am also like not really one of them. The things that you really want to pull from this memory stuff is how things like temporal and spatial locality can affect the way that your programs run. So we looked at that a little bit, like we really like dipped our toe into this with Intro Lab when we asked you that question about like the arrays and like why one was faster than the other one, even though they seem like the same array, right? And that has to do with some stuff that we'll go into with like how memory gets accessed. So the things that you guys need to pull from chapter 6 are like just understanding the concepts of that kind of like caching and how we access memory. And then really also just like there is a memory hierarchy, like pyramid, that you'll see again and again and again. So it's actually pretty easy to like remember. And just like knowing like how that pyramid is structured and like what things are like the least expensive and the most, like what memory is the most ubiquitous in your system and it's the least expensive and like really like what like different kinds of memory get used for. So like, you're not going to have to diagram out something like this. Like, we're not going to make you do that. It's really only important for your understanding or if like you're going to start becoming like a computer if you decide to like switch into engineering, sorry. And this kind of stuff is just like for like kind of FYI. Like, it's interesting. So if you look at like, you know, this is 1985 to 2015. This is access time over here. This is how quickly we can access data and memory. And this is like a logarithmic scale. So each of these is like, 10 times slower. It takes 10 times longer than the last like bar, right? So if you look at as time goes, has gone on, the memory has gotten better in general, I think is really what this says. You can like also see here in 2015, we started using solid state drives, which is huge. That was a huge improvement. You can also see, so here's like our DRAM, that SRAM is like much faster. And then we have like our CPU cycles here. So I mean, this actually goes back to, I mean, this ties into that memory hierarchy because at the very bottom, the hierarchy is structured so that the things that are like the most expensive and have the quickest access time are on top and things that are like the least expensive and are the slowest as far as access time go on the bottom. So whenever we finally see that pyramid, like that'll all tie in.
Effective cycle time, is that like, you know, how, based how on multi-core
on like a single instruction. So these are like nanoseconds.
Yeah, I just wonder what the difference is between effective and it looks like they started effective cycle time in 2003, maybe when they came out with multi-core.
So I think that gets answered in this next. I have to check about that, with that actually. So there's like a reason why. There's a difference between like the CPU cycle time and what actually happens. And that has to do, okay, so here we go. So here's that memory gap. So the CPU can execute billions of instructions per second. We have like very fast CPU, like very powerful processors at this point, right? The problem there is that the CPU actually gets the instructions that it's going to execute from memory, specifically from like that dynamic RAM. Our DRAM can only service tens or hundreds of millions of accesses per second. So our DRAM is slower than our CPU, and our CPU, although it's faster, has to wait on instructions from DRAM. And this creates kind of a bottleneck. So there's no way currently to really utilize the full potential of that speed from the CPU. And that's like kind of a conundrum for engineers and designers as far as like trying to like bridge that gap a little bit. But that's what I believe that graph is illustrating there.
So like effective time is like the real cycle time, and then cycle time would be like
that's like what that gap is. It gets slowed down because of the DRAM, and that is I think as far as we need to get today. So next time we'll talk about some of that locality. We're going to be talking about memory access stuff. I would give chapter 6 a little bit of a read. We will go over this on Thursday. So even though your brain will still be in like shell lab mode, like this is what we're going to be talking about. So just understand that you'll probably get a little bit of like extra time for shell and go ahead and try and like read a little bit of chapter 6 or just like start looking over it, looking through the slides because this locality stuff will come up And I think this shouldn't be like a really intense section. We actually, I think, move through this stuff pretty quickly. So we will probably be starting on like a tech lab. I'm not sharing my screen anymore, am I? We'll probably be starting on a tech lab sometime next week, which is going to be, I think, like a nice break for you guys, actually. I'm actually, now that this has all happened, I'm like really, really glad that we did shell log before a tech lab.
I have a question.
Yes.
Are we going to go over chapter 10?
Remind me what 10 is.
Like files and stuff.
I don't believe so.
That was Friday, Michael.
Oh, okay. Yeah. That was the input output stuff.
Yeah, I know it was. I'm still not, everything's not super clear yet, and I thought maybe we'd have a follow-up lecture on that.
We can do like a follow-up on that. We'll probably have time, so if at some point like you want to get like further into chapter 10, we can definitely do that. That's also like a thing we could do for, if you want me to set it up for like to maybe help hours on Wednesday, since I normally hang after.
I guess my thing is like, are we supposed to be using the in shell lab? Are we supposed to be using the Unix, IO Unix library or whatever, or the C standard library, IO stuff?
Really neither one. I mean, I think the slides at the very end basically say exactly all you need in shell lab is open, dupe to, close. Those are the three system calls.
Okay.
So,
all right, maybe I'm overthinking this then, I think.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess to be precise, those are going to be the lower level ones than the, you know, not F open and F close. You'll use open and close. Because we want file descriptors. And I think that the way to really illustrate this is the procfs activity on the schedule. So you can actually like see file descriptors for a real program. But I mean, you're right that we didn't like go into a great amount of detail on Friday. But that's because you don't need a great amount of detail for shell lab.
Cool.
Do like let us know what your questions are going forward.
Okay, I think I'm good, man. I understand those functions well, so I think I just need to kind of put it together.
All right. Nice to see some familiar faces out there, y'all.
Yeah, you were like
at
it using the webcams in this section, I feel like. It's nice. It's actually way, way nicer to see your guys' faces than just a blank screen. Like,
yeah, for sure.
We miss you. We are also bored. So
be that good.
All right, guys. So I will be in help hours Tuesday. I'll do Wednesday. If you guys want to talk about more chapter 10 stuff in Wednesday, I know I kind of like sent that email the morning of. So if you weren't able to, get to Matt's lecture, we can like run through some of that stuff too. So let me know if you want
video. Video, right, y'all?
Yeah, the video. We're getting the videos up really fast now, so you guys can definitely watch old lectures if you need.
Oh, cool! I wanted to we have access to that beautiful graph that you drew.
It's on the slides.
Yeah, if you look at
small
activity solution, that's there too.
Okay. Yeah, I just wanted to make sure it wasn't like. I like that one, so.
Okay, well, I'm glad. All right, guys. If nobody has anything else.
I'm good.
All right.
I appreciate it.
See you on Wednesday.
Stay healthy.
Yeah, stay healthy, guys.